Charles, you know we couldn't go into July without making sure we brought it back home for the soccer podcast, sir. What is going on? Talk to me, man. How have you been feeling about everything and all the drama that's been going on right now?
Club season came to an end, but, you know, we rolled right into the international game, you know, with the Gold Cup, Copa, Women's World Cup. So, you know, soccer never stops, man. There's always something going on. You know, transfer season is comparable to free agency, in my opinion, in the NBA. So it's never a dull moment in the football world. So I'm happy to be here. I stay occupied. I find myself in the mornings. I'm looking up my soccer transfer window before I even look into Brian Windhorst and Woj's basketball report. So good times, man. Good times.
It is really good times. And with that being said, we're so excited today. We're going to be welcoming two guests. And we might as well start it with what's undoubtedly exciting. These are two of my really good friends. And talking about the best league in the world currently, with no arguments from anybody from Spain and those who support them. We just have to give it up. But we would love to welcome to the show Dr. Peter Tyka and Dr. Jesse Tumlin. Peter, how are you, sir?
I'm great. Thank you for having me on. It's a real pleasure.
Excellent. Excellent. Jesse, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Great. Great. We're excited to have you both. I think without further ado, it's Pete, we'd love for you to kind of give a little bit of testament on your soccer fandom before we roll into talking all things Tottenham.
Well, I lived in Ireland for about a year, and I had access to a Sky Sports premium package. And so I watched a ton of games that year, became fully immersed in it. I would also be remiss and not being true to the history if I didn't say that playing FIFA on PlayStation also got me addicted to watching soccer.
Right.
Because it did. And that I've only been a fan for about 2 years, but it has added a richness to my sports life and enhanced my life in a lot of ways, because I think the game introduced me to sort of the patience and strategy and beauty of doing all the little things right, but then also the drama of scoring goals and injuries and red cards. So I feel like sort of reborn, having a rebirth of like watching sports and enjoying sports because of the game of soccer. And I wanted to pick a team and have some loyalty to a squad. And so I picked Tottenham because I think how global their team is. We have the best player from Kenya. We have Lamella, who's from Argentina. We have South Korea's, you know, best sports star. We also have a lot of homegrown products from England. Like, our team basically staffs and the World Cup team, even though we lost Trippier to that for this last round. Our Hugo Lloris is from France. Moussa Sissoko is from France. The list goes on and on. I just think they're a really cool group of guys. And so I kind of hopped on, I think, in the middle of like what has been a renaissance, as people have explained to me, the deeper history. So that's kind of my background.
Can't call him bandwagon at all, because when he started loving Tottenham, it was obviously in what I would call the middle of the Pochettino project, if you will, hashtag with that. But Pete, glad to have you on, and I think this is a very good time to have you and Charles kind of get into it a little bit. We didn't really talk about the Champions League final and what we really thought about the game. And and Pete, as a Tottenham fan, we'll let Charles start it out first, but what were your feelings going into the game, Charles?
I mean, they weren't healthy at the time. That kind of sucked. That being Harry's first game back, I was a little nervous. You know, having watched most of Liverpool's games down the stretch, I did feel like they were the better team. You know, after what they did to my beloved Barcelona, I had to give them the edge going into it. But, you know, I was always holding out hope that maybe Sonny could pull something out for me, make some magic. So, I mean, I was nervous, but I thought they had a good chance. You know, both being English teams, you know, they're familiar with each other. So, I mean, you know, it was what it was, but, you know, Liverpool was a better team. You know, Origi got his goal. You know, they figured out a way with that cheap penalty in the beginning. You know, I really feel like that put them on the back foot, you know, to begin the game. But I mean, best team won. I think them just getting to the Champions League final was an accomplishment. So, you know, hats off to them.
With what Charles mentioned about being a cheap penalty in the beginning, in the first 3 minutes, do you feel as though that was the case?
I felt like the ref could have not called it or called it, and he called it. That's not a good philosophy, but Moussa Sissoko is like pointing towards I don't know what he's doing there. He's pointing towards like the defense to get organized or something. smart play by Mane. He saw it. He went right for it. The ref, I don't know. The ref could have not called it, but when he did, it just changed the course of the game. It was upsetting, also because Sissoko's had an amazing year. He came from Newcastle. Nobody thought he would be this good, but he evolved into like one of our best players and a really dominant midfield player, even when our midfield was kind of lacking this year at times. So it was upsetting because then Klopp basically like exploited our weaknesses. He made us try to beat him from the midfield, and we couldn't do it, you know? We hadn't been scoring very much down the stretch of the season. So that was basically what Lucas Moura puts in that hat trick to get us into the final. That's kind of shocking anyways. But, you know, Liverpool beat us 2-1 at the end of the season because Hugo Lloris dropped the ball into the goal on a random play, which he normally wouldn't do. And Toby, like, missed it. So, I don't know. We had the potential to beat them, but I think that just changed the whole course of the game and really just made the game, like, not exciting from a fan's perspective. But, of course, that's never the ref's job. The ref's job is to make the call. So I think he could have not called it, but I think there was enough evidence there to call it. But he could have chosen not to, right? So that was a big choice.
Jesse, as a neutral, how did you, and I believe, if I'm not mistaken, if you were there, correct?
I was, yes.
Tell us about how did it feel to be in a pub and for that to happen. And then I think one of the things that we just didn't really cover right there was, and Pete touched on a little bit, was Lucas Moura. Why was Lucas Moura not the first person put on the team sheet, and being there as a neutral, but yet being at a pub locally there at the time, why did Harry Kane start, and should he have started?
Yeah, I mean, so I'll leave it for those skin in the game to critique the squad selection. I can tell you that the locals were very big on Harry Kane just because of how beloved he is in England, but honestly, so I watched the Europa League final and the Champions League final in the same pub in Fitzrovia in central London. And watching games, especially in London proper, is very strange because unless you are in a very specific part of town that has a very specific neighborhood population, what you're going to get is a lot of kind of randos and transients just because of how global a city London is. So for the first game, it was really interesting because the pub was, I wouldn't say it was evenly split, Chelsea and Arsenal, but it was leaning in the direction of Arsenal. And there was a regular there, this really loud Russian, who was clearly like the most dominant personality in the room. And he would scream at the TV the entire time. And he was an Arsenal supporter. And I think, and he would also like go at people who he believed were Chelsea supporters. And so over the course of the match, I was with my brother and my English friend Gabriel, who's a Norwich City supporter. And over the course of the game, which went pretty horribly pear-shaped for Arsenal, we were just kind of like when one of the goals would take place, we were just kind of amusedly chuckling at Arsenal's misfortune. And because of this, this guy got it in his head that we were Chelsea fans. And so when it came time, yeah, I'm not sure why. And when it came time to watch the Champions League final, he was back, and so were we. And so when the match started, he was supporting Liverpool for reasons, I guess just because he had a tribal disliking of Spurs that he wanted to act out. And every time Liverpool would do something good, he was positioned behind us. So we were in between the TV and him, which was not good. And every time Liverpool would do something good, or Spurs would do something bad, he would scream pretty much at us, "Not today, Chelsea fan," talking to us. And my friends thought he was saying, "Not today, Josephine," as if he was addressing someone whose name was Josephine. Because if you say Chelsea fan with a Russian accent, it comes out sounding Josephine. And so most of what I remember from the Champions League final is hoping that this dude was not going to spike a glass on the back of my skull, which gives you some insight into what it's like to watch live soccer locally in London pubs.
That is fantastic. Charles, did you just catch that? How my man came back?
Yeah, that's quite a tale. Like that's being in the belly of the beast right there.
Oh my gosh, that's crazy. Yeah. What a great share. Pete, were you happy that Harold Kane still was listed on the starting squad?
I think Posh made the best decision he could to try to win the game. When Harry gets a chance, he'll finish it. That's, I mean, you got to believe in that, I think. So I think he made the best decision he could, but it's tough because Lucas, I think, had two hat tricks down the stretch of the season. I think one against Fulham or somebody like that. Not Fulham. Somebody who played at the end of the season, he had a hat trick. And then he had, you know, significant goals in all of the, in a bunch of the Champions League games. So he's a devastating force. I think the pace he brings is like unlike anyone else on our team. But I still think Posh made the best decision, and he's going to be criticized no matter what he did. So, however, Harry can disappear sometimes from matches, and that's what happened, you know. But he was kind of neutralized by what happened in the starting 2 minutes because they were able to put more defensive forces into him, you know. So.
Speaking of Harry's disappearing hat, we're not talking about Potter and Harwards. Charles, you have some thoughts on Harold Kane. Why don't you share them? And do you think he should have been in the starting squad, the starting 11?
I mean, I understand why he started. I wouldn't have done it like the guys were saying. Lucas Moura was in better form, obviously having just scored that hat trick and obviously not being injured, so he was the more fit player. But you know, your talisman is your talisman for a reason. He's the, you know, you got to put him out there. So I mean, I understand it. You know, I'm not the biggest Harry Kane fan, obviously. I think he's a little overhyped, and he does have the tendency to disappear in big games. That's my biggest problem with him. That's the reason that I'm such a big Son fan, is because I feel like he steps up in those big games, in those big moments, where a guy like Harry Kane kind of, you know, shrinks in the moment. But I mean, like I said, Posh gets paid the big bucks, so is Harry Kane, you know, to be in that position and make the, you know, and come through and bring home a championship for the team. So that's what those guys get paid to do, so he's got to be out there.
Can I jump in here real quick?
Please.
Yeah, again, I don't have a ton of skin in the game with this, but I feel like Poch's decision with the selection here, it almost, to me, comes down to his lack of a title-winning record. And
yes,
that everyone regards him as an excellent manager, but he doesn't quite have the CV to be able to make these kind of choices with confidence, because you replace, so you imagine Nick Saban will make this move, right? Nick Saban will pull his starting quarterback in the national championship. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't really give a damn whether you disagree with his logic. His track record is what it is, and he's not staking his reputation. Well, I mean, he's kind of staking his reputation on these decisions, but he has the self-confidence and the fan trust to be able to make that incredibly high-stakes move. Whereas Poch, like, for all of his supposed positive qualities, like, he doesn't have the resume yet to be able to be that bold and make that call when the highest, you know, stakes are on the table.
Charles, you hear that right there? That was some SEC knowledge getting dropped.
And yeah, that was correlation. I mean, it makes perfect sense. Yes, it does.
Because what are his trophies? That's what it always comes back to. And once again,
that was good,
Pete.
Was
we're really not good. Trying to. This is not a beat up like Tottenham session. I think they have to peel this onion off a little bit and just figure it out of like, all right, how long does a project take? And is he okay being potentially Arsene Wenger of like, if he gets a top four and like, I mean, hell, Arsene was at least winning an FA Cup trophy. Like Tottenham, people like say like, oh, that clearly doesn't matter as much as like, you know, the big two or whatnot, as like if you were to fill out a treble. It matters though. Trophies matter. Because it'd be able to show, like, what is our accomplishment at the end of the year of, like, and yes, when we're talking about transfer money, and obviously wonderful job for them to get their Champions League money out of that. But goodness.
At the end of the day, it just comes down to power and, you know, who's in the position to exert themselves like that, power and pressure. Because if Pochettino's not, if he's under that pressure, so he's making that decision, as to where Nick Saban isn't under pressure because Nick Saban's the most powerful person in the state of Alabama. And they can't fire him, really, unless, you know what I'm saying? Like,
right.
there's a certain, you
that's
know,
a
power
good point.
In that. And also, in that given situation, the most powerful person at Tottenham is Harry Kane at the moment, not Poch, in my opinion. So, you know,
is
like
he?
I said,
he's the
captain of the English national team, yes.
Jesse, with your experience being over there during the World Cup, what is he considered? Like, is he supposed to deliver? If we had to, like, say, like, we're fast-forwarding 10 to 12 years, does he have to win a World Cup for him to be adored in England, or he will be seen as a failure, or he has to win Champions League at Tottenham? Like, he can't go to Barcelona in 2 years and win the Champions League and like how will he be viewed?
I think if he succeeds with a foreign club, it's not a barrier to his reputation locally as much as his performance with the national team is.
Okay.
I mean, one thing I think that is just really unique about the English football landscape is the utterly toxic relationship that the national team, the media, and the fan base have. It's like this sort of Bermuda Triangle of awfulness. And especially with the media, right? Like, the media, it reminds me of a kind of supercharged, not to cross the wires again, but it reminds me of a kind of supercharged version of the program climate with Tennessee football, right? Like, the fans have unrealistic expectations. The media has a toxic relationship with the program. The program, like, has some major structural issues that are stopping it from achieving the kind of success the fans expect. And every time the players are put in a high-intensity situation, they wilt because of the other two components. They wilt because of the fan expectations, and they wilt because of the media toxicity. And I think this crop of English players, especially because they're young and talented, they've got good and bad balance of unique factors relative to the kind of older squad that they replaced that was dominated by people like Gerrard, Lampard, even Beckham before that, because they're young and fresh, which means they have potential and they have like a little bit of rope from the fans, but they also are re-intensifying expectations in a way that just encourages the toxicity cycle to start again. And I think you see Kane does a better job, in my opinion, of handling that storm than some of the other young England players right now. And that was, you know, one of the big narratives of the sort of end of this season. But, you know, when I was there last summer, right, watching the World Cup matches, the utter jubilation at England's success was something that I have rarely in sports. Like, I was in Oxford. I was in Oxford during the knockout stage, and people just shut down the streets. Like, after England's victories, people just walked out of their homes and just shut down the streets. And people were singing, you know, the football's coming home song for just hours and hours and on end, because you can just tell that the population, or at least the football watching population, right, was just crying out for the catharsis of watching England succeed. And then, of course, when they're knocked out, it's back to just sort of one damn thing after another. But you do get this sense that this is a fan base that is absolutely neurotic, on the razor's edge of emotion about whether to either vilify or anoint this team as, you know, as the champions of the world or the worst people on the planet. And again, they're not unlike Tennessee in that way. Like, but the palpable toxicity of that relationship is something that I think doesn't exist anywhere else on the planet. I mean, there are fan bases in Latin America, for example. Argentina comes to mind, right? Where the fans are absolutely rabid, and especially in the way they hold their team to account. But the toxicity is of a different quality, right? Like, there is a kind of lethal toxicity to Latin American football fanhood. But at the end of the day, there is a sense that everybody is on the same team in a figurative sense. And there's as much tears as there are, like, violent implications when the team disappoints. In England, it's not tears. It's just disappointment and then just poison. And so I think I think it was Rooney who said once that it was like wearing a weighted vest.
Huh.
When he stepped on the field for England, it was like wearing a weighted vest.
Or drinking a bunch of pints and smoking a bunch of cigarettes.
Well, that, yeah.
I'm getting back on the pitch. Sorry.
No,
I mean, that I was rapping, so yeah.
Nah, Pete.
Yeah.
As a Tottenham fan, and like in terms of making sure we put a wrap on this with Harry Kane, this is what we were hoping for in terms of discussion. What do you qualify as a success for? So take that first, and then secondly, do you think him and Pochettino are linked in terms of success for now on? And do you, like, their marriage will always last?
I mean, I think success for him now has to be, like, a championship of some sort. Because he's taken home a bunch of golden boots, right? He's always going to be in the conversation for the highest scoring striker in the league, because he gets into the right position for headers. He gets into the box. He cleans up. He also takes control. He takes shots from distance. Whenever he sees any daylight, he's shooting it, even if there's somebody on his right or left. I also think he's a highly underrated passer. Like, that's another thing about putting him in against Liverpool that just occurred to me that I wanted to say, was that he actually opens up the midfield and the attack in a way that Lucas Moura never could, I think. Because if you watch Kane, he curls balls in, he sends shots, like he sends passes like 60, 70 yards towards other attackers. He makes the right pass and decision of the midfield to like chip it off to Eriksen or to Son or to Dele in a way that like opens up the defense in a way that other players can't. So I think that is an advantage he offered in that situation. But I really think at this point it's got to be winning some type of championship, whether it's for England or whether it's for Tottenham, because what else can he do? What else he has to add that to his resume to be a true champion? I mean, we talk about like great NBA players who never won a championship. Their CV will always be missing something, right? The same way with any like great quarterback in the NFL. I think he's basically at that point in his career. And yeah, maybe him and Posh are basically like in this together. You can't imagine Tottenham ever selling Harry Kane. That's a good question, but I also think like he's always gonna put Harry Kane in. And I think there were some interesting statistics out which I never corroborated or verified, that like we win as much as we lose with Harry, right? It was something like we lose, putting him in doesn't always like mean winning, right? But he's always gonna go in anyways for a lot of different reasons. But I think Posh is always going to be committed to having Harry as like his cornerstone strategy for attacking and breaking down defenses, if that makes any sense.
Charles, what's your rebuttal to that? Because you don't, clearly, I don't feel like you give Harry the benefit of the doubt ever, but from what you're able to see as one Tottenham fan this year than ever before. Because
well, I think just one last thing before you jump in too is like at Ajax, like he goes into the halftime and yells at his team. Right, he goes in that we're down, we're losing. Like all the reports that he went in there and basically gave a huge speech and yelled at his team and asked them, like, "Is this how you want this to end?" So I think he's doing so much for Posh as like a leader too, right? And coaches depend upon that to win games as well. So like we're talking about passing, moral leadership, courage, symbolism of leading England, and as well as like a raw amount of goals, which no one else can really match. Like in terms of production. Numerically for goals, there's nobody else in world soccer who's with him on this, right? Salah is like now approaching that, right? So, but in terms of like raw production, like he has those five things, I think, and that's why Posh is going to go to him. So there's a moral leadership quality about him too, right?
Man, that's a good point. Okay, Charles, some thoughts on that?
I mean, I agree with all that, but it doesn't matter if you don't win. And I think, you know, he's got to win something, like we were just saying. He's got to win something at the end of the day, whether, you know, even had they won, you know, the Nations League, that would have sufficed. But, you know, I think they run into the same, you know, cycle with games, you know, he played in that game as well. You run into the same cycle where they keep getting close. So I think that, you know, as much as what adds to the pressure is that, like, they get all of England's hopes back up that they're, you know, you look up and they're in the semifinal or something, or the quarterfinal or something. So then they're like, maybe this is the team, maybe this is the time, maybe this is the start of the golden age. And then they lose in the semifinals or whatever, you know, in some game that's disappointing. And they always, you know, they always end up playing in the third place game that nobody cares about. And so I just think that just builds and keeps building, and they got to have a breakthrough. And if he's really this, you know, top five player, this, you know, transcendent player, he's got to be the one that makes that breakthrough for them. And I just feel like there are too many times in big games where there are these moments for him to, you know, to be had and for him to kind of step out and to really be that guy in that echelon of player, that he doesn't show up. And so it's just, that's my feeling on it. But he's got to win something. And my personal belief is he's not going to win in England. He needs to, I think eventually he'll end up on Real Madrid. I think Lawson will be good with that. But I think that's when he'll get his shine and really get his championships on, because I don't really, you know, as much as I love Tottenham, I don't really see a way forward for him in the near future, and he's not getting any younger.
Don't you think, though, that like a victory at Real Madrid or Barcelona means less than one at Tottenham?
Oh, for sure. But I feel like that. That's just
a great question.
Everybody can go to Real Madrid and like win.
That's not true. Not everybody.
Okay, that's
can.
Not true. That's not true. You're right. But, you know, I just feel like, okay, they win. Congratulations. That's got to feel good, but like, it's less of an accomplishment than like a team in the Premier League that places like fourth or fifth. So maybe he's like emotionally committed to that project, or maybe it's just me and I'm reading it onto it as a fan, or like hoping desperately that that's what they believe. Right. Because when people are talking about Posh leaving, I'm like, Posh isn't going to leave. He believes in this project. He wants to see it through, which is a dumb argument because money is there to like go coach elsewhere. Right.
So my question would be, so then do you think Harry Kane's going to stay at Tottenham his whole career? Or do you, I see him changing teams at some point. That's what I'm saying.
It's inevitable. I mean, well, let's take that back. Do you see him changing? I think the question is, do you see him changing teams in his prime? Because you can change like after 32. Let's call it before 30. He turns 32 years old.
I don't have enough knowledge of like sports of football long term to know how players behave over time. So I defer to you. But maybe it matters too that he's like an academy product and like one of our own. You know. But also, this is politics. This is also about money and dollar signs, too. I guess, like, as a fan of Tottenham, like, you invest emotions in it. But I don't know. I mean, why do you think he would? I'm asking because I don't know the answer to that question at all.
Like I said, it just seems like the natural progression of how these things go. But more so, my opinion is, you know, other than the rare cases, which Harry Kane is, he's like Messi, where he, you know, he is an academy product and he's been there the entire time. Like Messi and those guys have been. So they're going to stay. He might be able to stay. But now that they've built a new stadium, they've kind of stepped up into the upper echelon with money and finances, too, to where he might not need to change teams. But, you know, traditionally, those guys from, you know, teams that are in the back end of the Big Six, you know, what do you do when Man U finally just, you know, decides to put, you know, $220 million down for him or something? If it ever comes to that, does he say no to a United offer that big? You know what I mean? It's just, I just don't see him, you know, staying there the whole time. And he's, what is he, is he 25 now? Or is he, like in
just
3 years?
Just like Eriksen is right now, right?
Yeah. Like in 3 years, do I see Harry Kane on? Because I feel like the rumors of him leaving have been, you know, small and grumbling, but I've heard them. And then, you know, I just feel like that grows over time. And if they don't win anything for another 2 or 3 years, then that pressure builds on that. And then does he need a new challenge? Does he need a new team? Does he need a fresh start? And, you know, those things start to bubble up. So I don't know. I just feel like with the progression of these things, how they normally go is that at some point there's going to be at least an opportunity for him to leave.
My take on this, after 15 some odd years of watching Spurs from a distance, is I feel like this conversation is substantially different now than it would have been, say, even 5 years ago.
Sure.
I mean, I think for starting in the early 2000s, Spurs were basically the quintessence of the selling club of English football.
Yes.
They would develop a lot of players. They would get a lot of players discovered, and then those players would leave on high profile transfers, crucially to other domestic powerhouse clubs, right? Like United or, you know, abroad, yes, but they would sell domestically, right? Like Dimitar Berbatov's going to get bought at the top of his game. I think that conversation has now shifted to where Spurs has made strategic investments and strategic decisions. I used to think Daniel Levy was the worst GM in world football. Now I'm having to reevaluate what I think of him as a business strategist, because Spurs have made an incredible pivot to a club that actually is prioritizing success and actually is seeing some of it. Now, I agree with Charles that I could see Kane making a move to Spain, but that remains a typical move, I think, for late career English stars. And I think part of that, there are a couple reasons for it. One is just the incredible buying power of especially Real Madrid. And two is a much more abstract sociological reason, which is that every post-war Englishman dreams of retiring to Spain. And you see people from Beckham to, you know, even before Beckham, you'd see people from like United's earlier eras of success going to the continent. People like Gareth Bale, that sort of thing. So even the upper echelons of English football will sell to Real, both because of their buying power, but because of the weird pipeline that everyone in English society kind of aspires to, which is like you want your second home somewhere in Spain. And I don't think that is a representation that Spurs are an underpowered club these days. I think that is evidence that they have finally entered an echelon of English football where hopefully you only sell to Spain.
Oof, man, that's a great deep dive into that. I think overall, Pete, you know, for Tottenham fans, I think actually I think this is the most successful year that's been under the Poch watch, if you will, because even though there's some opportunity that they may not have made the top four, but they ended up handling that, and at one time I believe they got up to second and were only 2 points away They were above Manchester City and were only 2 points outside of Liverpool. Like, it was, and then Harry got hurt, and then you guys battled back and made a final. And unfortunately, it just was a domestic final, because it would have been so interesting to see. Because you guys aren't scared of Barcelona. That was another thing. So I was like, oh man, if this actually were worked out, I'm like, oh my God, there's like a path for Tottenham actually to win this thing, because you guys actually wouldn't have even been in. Charles, do you remember that night when we talked?
Yeah.
Because with Tottenham, they got in on the late goal. They wouldn't even made the knockout stage.
Because
the late goal against Barca, even though Barca didn't have, like, I don't think they played like their full their strongest, but still, it was impressive for them. So, I think nothing, never to fret, if you will, people. It'll be when we bring you on 12 months from now, even though you'll have other appearances, is that we're actually talking about, like, you guys actually got something done.
I think that was a dangerous Harry Kane cross to Lucas Moura into the box.
Yes,
as I recall, and I just think, like, that was a good, you know, that's
and
a good.
And the Camp Nou, if I'm not mistaken, as well.
It's a good symbol for the entire season, like grit and determination, hanging on.
It was a hell of a run, hell of a run.
Even referencing that game, that goes back to our conversation about the Champions League final. Why didn't he just start both of them?
Exactly. And I've wondered about that too. Just like, appease the people, be like, all right, this is the guy who literally got us here, and this is the guy who actually has helped our team. I just don't. I think he's gonna be thinking about that. He has to be thinking.
And
you're
fighting fire with fire. At least you know how Liverpool is gonna come out and try to play you. At least you're fighting their attack with your attack.
Yeah, I don't want to. I mean, I'm happy for my friends who are Tottenham fans. I think they have a much brighter future right at the moment, even though the project is just way bigger with their North London neighbors and with Arsenal. But Tottenham, like, has at least shown a roadmap. And speaking of that, and actually when I thought that this team would be different this year is when they went to Old Trafford and won 3-0, even though I saw Jose Mourinho coming on the pitch, clapping it up and clapping to the fans and being like, well, we played way better than what the actual score was. I don't know what that meant. But all I know is that Tottenham just went into Old Trafford and handled their business 3-0, and Tottenham was off the races. They had 9 points after the first three. I thought they was about to be on a run, and it did it. But a good transition to where that actually, I think, signaled the beginning of the end for Jose Mourinho. And Jesse, our resident United fan here, I don't even want to know what's like what happened. We know what happened. We saw what happened. Like, things just went awry after PSG. What is going on in the future? What's set up right
now? Well, the club's not in a very good place. I don't think anyone who's not delusional would argue differently. I mean, and the biggest problem is definitely Ed Woodward.
Yes.
And I'll say, like, earlier in my United fanhood, I participated, you know, in my own small way in the anti-Glazer hate. But I mainly just kind of did that in a recreational sort of way, because I thought that it was something that authentic United fans should be doing. I didn't really have the perspective or the insider information to be able to understand why. So, you know, you kind of go along with your Newton Heath gear and your green and gold or whatever. Now, at this juncture, it's really difficult to look at the way Ed Woodward is running the club and not see him as an intractable barrier to the club's success. I mean, you hear horror stories, for example, about how Anthony Martial is Joel Glazer's favorite player. And for this reason, he, in addition to being unsellable, is going to command a new contract at the beginning of 2019 for a player that is unproductive and is unlikely to be used by this or future managerial regime, but who is being coddled essentially because he is beloved of the son of the owner. And that kind of thing is the kind of thing you look at and say, this is no longer a club that is being run along serious principles that have any kind of football related in. You could still construct a plausible argument that the club is being run along commercially viable lines, because it continues to be very profitable in terms of annual overhead, but it's still incredibly heavily leveraged in in a more bird's eye sense in terms of the debt that the Glazers have put on the club in order to acquire it in the first place. And so its annual turnover margin, even while healthy, doesn't speak to the overall financial health of the club, and it damn sure does not speak to the footballing success of the club, which has continued to get more and more mediocre, and is the kind of thing that will eventually hollow out the financial safety and viability of the club as well, because there's only so many seasons that you can spend outside of Champions League competition and expect the club to remain commercially viable. You know, even if the goal is overpaying Alexis Sanchez by a factor of in a vain bid to sell shirts in Latin America, you're not even going to be able to overplay high profile foreign transfers anymore if you can't attract the kind of player who wants to be playing high profile European football. So this entire model is headed for a wreck, both on the pitch. I mean, it's kind of already had its reckoning on the pitch, but it's headed for its reckoning off the pitch. And, you know, I don't want to give a sense of, you know, there's no moral superiority to be found anywhere here, because the alternative to this is signing on to some kind of petrodollars oriented ownership that, you know, maybe using the profits of extreme exploitation to fund your club's transfers. So I'm not saying that I'm desirous of that in the long term, but the club's in a pretty bad way structurally, and it's hard to see this ownership or this management, this front office management anyway, taking it anywhere else. Mm. So that's uplifting.
Charles, United from an outside and neutral's point of view, after hearing a resident fan there, I was reading a quote. You and I actually talked about this in early June when we read an article that was comparing actually the Lakers and United about how their brands, and unfortunately in terms of like how they should like need to rectify their mistakes and what was going on and the overzealous ways of Ed Glazer. Do they have the best scouts? Do they have the best management? Why are clubs like this, like even of this nature, they're two of the biggest brands in all sports. Why are they dealing with some of the like simplest things in terms of getting the right people to evaluate talent or the right people to manage a club?
I just think it's because, you know, over time when you're so used to having these big names and these stars that just want to come to your team, whether it be the Lakers or Man U, it gives you the ability to not focus on those smaller things, not worrying about scouting and things of that nature. Similar problem happened to the Yankees for a couple years after their championships, where their farm system was terrible because they were spending so much money throwing it at, you know, Carl Pavano and those trash relievers that, you know, starters they were getting back in the day, that they had that problem where their farm system was terrible and they had all these high-priced free agents that didn't pan out. Same thing has happened with United. They don't have too many homegrown players, and then all the guys that they've brought in haven't produced. You brought Alexi in for all that money, didn't do anything. You brought Paul in, he hasn't done much. Same thing with the Lakers. They brought in Dwight, they brought in Steve Nash. Same problem they had. So when you stake so much of your franchise on these bigger players and they don't pan out, it just fucks you in the long run. You know, when you go for this short-term fix, you know, and it creates these long-term problems.
Yeah, and we even have a little bit more medium-term record of doing exactly this, right? I mean, in the past several seasons, we've done similar moves to what's happened with Alexis, with Falcao, with Angel De Maria, people who come in on extraordinary wage packets and produce almost literally nothing. The only partial success story that we've created out of this model in recent years has been Ibrahimovic, who is like so irrepressible as a freak athlete that he kind of can't not be productive. But even he, there were arguments about underproduction relative to his price tag. I mean, you just look at this Alexis Sanchez deal. I mean, he's the highest paid player in the league. He's making about £1 per second and is totally unused. I mean, what kind of boon to Arsenal it is that we took this guy off of their books? And if you expand from there, you look at the top six players on our payroll, right? Are Alexis Sanchez, Pogba, Martial, De Gea, Lukaku, and Fred in that order. Of those players, we are actually 1.5, like depending on how you rate Pogba and what his future with the club is. About, and even De Gea, right, may be on his way out. But that's the top six people on our payroll. And potentially none of them have a future at the club. And at least four of them have been utterly useless to the club over the past, say, calendar year. Now, you tell me what kind of business acumen it takes to set up that kind of situation. Because together, we're talking about well over £1 billion worth of, not £1 billion. You're looking at, on a monthly basis, or even a weekly basis, you're talking about spending well over £1 million on just those players. And for what?
Jesse, and quickly, if you can summarize for us, is Pogba back on the squad next year?
I keep seeing different things. I mean, I think it's pretty clear from what's been reported at this point that he wishes to leave.
But will you still?
Though, as everything with Pogba and with anyone who's represented by Mino Raiola, there's no way to really be sure what is smoke and what's fire, right? Mino Raiola is, I think the best analogy for him is that he's kind of like the Rich Paul.
Yes, Charles, you hearing that?
Football.
That's what I was thinking. As he said it, I was thinking about Rich.
Yeah. And it's like anytime you deal with the player that this guy represents, you are signing yourself up for an absence of conflicting media narratives, intentionally produced drama, and ultimately incredibly poor contract situations and personnel choices. And so you're seeing this right now with both Paul Pogba and Matthias De Ligt. Right, who in a lot of ways is kind of like he's the flavor of the summer. And Raiola's got both these guys in his stable. And the Matthias De Ligt situation is almost even crazier at this point in terms of the leaks and the narrative that are coming out of that transfer saga. But it's difficult. He manages the players he represents in such a fine-grained way that every time there's a media story reported, it's difficult to tell whether that is something that the player truly thinks or believes, or whether it's something that has been dropped by Raiola in order to create the kind of narrative pressure he wants to kind of advance the transfer sagas of the player in question. And so when Pogba says, you know, he wants a new challenge or something, whether it's at Real or whether it's at Juve, I believe on balance that he probably wants out, but I don't really know how to evaluate the information that I hear about it, A, and B, it's not clear to me either what Ed Woodward's strategy will be in this regard, because you could potentially tell him he's going nowhere, right? And you're weighing that against the possibility of like a Kyrie situation. I mean, arguably Pogba's already done this, right? There's an extremely cynical take on this past season that said, well, actually, Mourinho is the real victim here, and there was some potential with that squad set up, but Pogba was unhappy, and he poisoned the locker room, and that both got Mourinho sacked and tanked our chances of doing anything this season. Now, I'm not saying I necessarily subscribe to that view. I don't think it's an insane take, however, because I think Pogba does have the emotional volatility and the international clout to swing your locker room, your dressing room, excuse me, in one direction or the other. So I think you could argue that it makes strategic sense to say to Pogba, no, you're going nowhere. You're going to stay where you are until we build a better core of players around you, frankly, and give Solskjaer an opportunity to operate how he's capable of operating. But the risk that you take on in that is that Pogba's unhappiness and his general attitude in the dressing is going to torpedo this or any regime's chances of success, and that it's better on balance to just jettison this whole situation, right? And jettison Mino Raiola along with him. Just like you don't want Rich Paul running your front office and taking on, you know, Tristan Thompson's contract. You don't want Mino Raiola's involvement in your front office and all of the other additional bad contracts that it could mean for you down the road. So I think there is a pretty strong argument here for just saying, you know what, we're in rebuilding mode right now, if we're being perfectly honest. And on that basis, why don't we just actually have a fresh start here with some young talent, try to develop some people and get all of the distraction out of the way.
I'm not going to ask you if they'll be in the top four, whether they can Europa yet, because I still want to see how the squads are out. obviously the part was young Rashford already. Are the deals done with Wan-Bissaka?
I think what I was reading this morning is that he had a medical, and that
Good.
But so, you never know with Ed Woodard. I mean, that guy is so incompetent. Like, he in previous seasons has actually bungled the transfer deadline fax situation. I mean, it's like that's how bad he is at his job. So I don't believe anything until I see that the ink is dry on somebody.
Speaking of the ink is dry, and talk about breaking up with your girlfriend because you thought you was going to get a 10 somewhere else and you be the man. I'll tell this compared to this. Say you were the star. Looking like you couldn't play quarterback at the small town Texas school, but so you went to transfer somewhere else, thought you could be the man there, but now you want to come back and get coached by the same folks. Sound like somebody you know, Charles, from Barcelona?
It's real disrespectful.
It is what it is. It is
come
what
on
it
home,
is.
Neymar. Come on home.
Uh-huh. Come on. So speaking of which, so since Neymar's been gone, Messi has not won any titles that involve anything outside of the Spanish league, as we know. Is this necessary for y'all to get back to, I mean, what are you guys? Are you guys the best club in the world right now or not?
I feel like we're the best club in the world. Just one season doesn't define who the best club in the world is. I think we have the best program in the world. We have the best system.
One season? Where have you all been the last three?
Who's been a better club this decade?
I just asked a question.
I'm just saying, like you say, like they haven't won anything outside of Spain. Like we poo-poo winning the Spanish league. Yeah, we're talking about Tottenham, who can never win, you know, their league. Like the basis. No, I'm just saying, like the basis of like the the defining things in these, who are these really truly great teams, are like the teams that have hardware. Like it doesn't matter. It does honestly doesn't matter what the hardware is anymore. Like everybody wants to win something. Like we were talking about England. Had they won the Nations League, we would have given them credit for that. So I mean, they're still winning tournaments. They're just not winning the Champions League, and that's for many more reasons than because we don't have Neymar anymore.
Very good. Very good. Is he coming home?
I don't think so. I think PSG is gonna have to lower their demands. I feel like he's a poison pill in their locker room. So the last thing they want is for him to be on the team next year from what the chairman said and from the vibe they've been giving off. So I mean they don't really have any leverage in that situation. I feel like if they don't want him there and he doesn't want to be there, they're gonna have to lower that price. But I don't think they'll be able to. It's gonna be a tricky situation to get Griezmann and Neymar back for the balance to be financial fair play.
Sure.
You know, on deck. So it'll be interesting. I know he wants to come back, but I just don't know if this is gonna be the year. There might be a way for him to come back mid-season or in the first transfer season, obviously the new year, or next summer maybe. If he has another bad year in Paris, I can see him coming home next year. But I just don't see a way in which it can get done this year.
So Griezmann, is that all but done deal? What is a better chance of happening? It's on Griezmann or Neymar?
Griezmann by far. I'd say it's. We're 90, probably 90% there with Griezmann, if not more. So we're just waiting for July 1st to hit when his transfer clause drops from 200 million to 120, and then game's on. So I think he'll be in Catalonia next year, ready to go.
Okay. I want to ask you, are you guys going to be done with what's going on with Mbappe? Will he have to go Coutinho? Are you guys waiting to see how he does in Brazil and finishing up with Copa before making a final decision?
I think it really depends on how this Neymar situation shapes up. If we have to get rid of those guys to fund that deal, then I definitely think it's going to happen. I'm interested to see what Bayern's going to do in this their newfound pursuit of Dembele. There are obviously some English teams who might have some interest in Coutinho. So, I mean, I'm not opposed to getting rid of Coutinho, obviously. He has looked better in the Copa America, but I wish he had that form for us at any point ever. But I'd like to keep Dembele, keep him healthy. We'll see. Like I said, we still got time and some players got to make their move. So we're going to make it happen. I got a feeling we're going to make another push for the Champions League. And you know there might be a trouble in there in our future. So I'm just staying positive.
Okay, all right, very good. Speaking of which, I know you have some thoughts on Christian Eriksen. Pete, do you think that what are the chances of him being able to stay in Tottenham? And then there was also Charles with you. Is he more likely for Barcelona or more likely for Madrid if he's to leave?
It's tough. I mean, he has a year left on his contract after this, so if we didn't sell him now, right, we would be standing to lose a ton of money. But I feel like Levy's going to have a really high price point for him. I think he's alluded to the fact that he wants to try something new, obviously, but could stay at Tottenham if things work out. I don't know. It's hard to say. He's 26. He is an incredible passer, like a maestro of an orchestra. He'd be a huge asset on any team. It might be the time to sell him and take a bunch of money in and then reconstruct like we did with some other players. But if the price point isn't right, I mean, what if we had it for another season and that could work out well if we get some more transfers coming in? It's a good question. I don't know. It's hard to say, but it will be really tough to lose him. And I think, you know, we talk about Harry Kane a lot as like Tottenham's main player, but nothing really works in the system without Eriksen, or at least doesn't work nearly as well, you know? But it might be time for him to go in his career. He might have reached the threshold that we were discussing earlier, like with time for him to leave and time for him to make a bunch of money off him. But we'll see how it goes. I mean, they gotta have the right price point, I think. But he's also, I think, his agent or like whoever's PR person basically shut him down from public speaking after like whatever he said earlier set off a firestorm. So we're not gonna know much until it actually happens, I think. But it wouldn't surprise me if he left. It wouldn't surprise me, but it would be devastating for our team.
What are you hearing out of Spain, Charles? Is Eriksen, you think Madrid or you think Barcelona?
I haven't been hearing too much on the Barcelona side. We're kind of, you know, we brought in Frankie. We brought in Arthur, was it last year? So we're kind of stocked with midfielders. We need defenders and attacking players. We're kind of clogged up in the middle of the pitch. He definitely seems like he fits the profile of a Madrid player. I don't know if where he'd slide in, if he could take maybe take Isco's spot in the midfield, or Toni Kroos is on the back end of
that guy.
We're not giving Isco airtime, not for no reasons. But yeah, I could see him sliding in the midfield there. Modric and those guys are slowing down, so maybe might be some room there for him. But if I'm Tottenham, I'm trying to keep him at all costs.
Yeah.
He's too vital to what they got going on.
I'm so impressed. I think he's their best player, like, for this past season overall. Obviously, with the injuries and things of that nature, I thought he made things go. I think they need Dele to get back into form. But, man, they were superb when they're all clicking like that. It is. And now I'm hearing there's talks about De Gea and then Donnarumma going to PSG. Jesse, what are you hearing on that front? Are you guys going to be able to keep your keeper?
Yeah, kind of similarly here. I mean, I think there have been rumors that De Gea wants out for over a year now. I think De Gea contra Pogba, right, doesn't have the kind of personality that makes him like locker room poison when he's unhappy. But the thing that has started to change my mind on this a little bit over the past season is that we saw on the back half of this season that De Gea's mental attitude is capable of affecting his game. So he's been the best player on our squad for the better part of 2 or 3 years now. And I think it has been regarded by many as one of the best keepers in the world.
Yes.
But towards on the back half of this season, he committed a fair few like serious howlers that are very uncharacteristic of him. And it's a weird psychoanalytic, you know, take to speculate about exactly why this is. But I think it would be weird not to connect this to his general unhappiness about both the state of the club itself and his continued presence at it. And so I liked it. I like De Gea. I want him to succeed in what he does. I don't have the same kind of generally negative relationship as a fan that I do with Pogba with De Gea. And so I would love for De Gea to stay. And I think he can be convinced to stay. I think a lot of this comes down to the relationship that he's developed with Solskjaer. But the thing that worries me the most has been the glimpses we've seen of this season about how his performance is going to suffer if he wants away and can't get away. And that has started to change my attitude on that. Kind of like with Pogba, where if you can get over $100 million for this guy, for a squad that is basically in rebuilding mode and is going to have difficulty attracting top dollar talent and is being run by effectively miserly assholes, then why not get a quarter of $1 billion for De Gea and Pogba right now and use it to buy players that are going to buy into Solskjaer's system and be building blocks for the club going forward?
Charles, do you think that's their best place that they should go to?
He's not the best keeper in the EPL like he was a couple years ago.
Sure.
I feel like his value is slipping. So I feel like you need to sell while you still can and still get some good money for him, because I feel like he's been passed by both of the Brazilian keepers, and that's only going to keep, I feel like, getting worse, because the defense in front of him is terrible, and he's just going to keep looking bad and keep getting exposed. So I feel like now's the time to get out. So
I think that's exactly right. I think our inability to invest in especially central defenders has tanked his value to a certain degree. And I guess the one thing I would say contra that is that the rumors that I've heard about what United would do if De Gea departed make even less sense than keeping him. They involve spending like upwards of £70 million on somebody else. I forget who I was reading in the report on this. It might have been the guy at Atletico, but it involves bad business, right? And on that basis, if Ed Woodward, in all his wisdom, is going to just sell De Gea only in order to turn around and spend extremely high money on somebody that he expects to step in on day one and replicate that production, doesn't make sense. And it's just going to waste more money for the club. And on that basis, I would say, like, you need to make De Gea happy, not do a bad business deal where you're trying to replace him with somebody who you can only hope will be as good as he is. And as usual with the Glazers and Woodward, there's not really a correct answer here.
Interesting. It's going to be a fun summer. There are a lot of moves that are going to be made. I think Madrid definitely took a step back. Not used to seeing them go through, obviously, from the managers. It'll be three managers within a 13-month process. They also lost Cristiano Ronaldo. We didn't even get to talk about Juve yet, because we want to see what exactly is going to happen with them. But we wanted to make sure I think Barcelona is the one that's heating up right now. And then PSG, they're pretty much in when the Champions League, or you'll be fired in 2 years too. That's just how that's unfortunately for Thomas Tuchel. Lots of things that are going to be happening. Really exciting times. Fellas, we can't thank you enough for being able to join the podcast today. Pete, give you 15 seconds on your lasting thoughts on, are you excited for the summer for in Tottenham and where you think they're going?
I'm excited. I think we're going to spend. We're going to get some new midfielders. I think that's crucial. I think we're about to sign Clark from Leeds. I think it's time to spend, bolster the midfield, and go in the season with a bunch of optimism. I think we're gonna fight for the title of the EPL this year.
Oh, we'll hold you to that. That's big talk.
I think we're actually going to compete. We're not going to collapse or like plateau the way we did this year. I think we'll be in the title race down to the end of the season.
Okay. All right. Jesse, in one word, in 15 seconds, what's the success for United?
My mood is grim. I, over the course of my life, have kind of depended on United and latterly the Celtics to be my consistently stable clubs that don't constantly sap my will to live. And both of those are in free fall right now. So it's kind of a dark time for me personally, if I'm perfectly honest. But, as far as like what's possible this summer, I'd settle for, building out a central defense that is athletic and I know that we can trust in the kind of high press that I think Solskjaer wants to run.
Okay.
That's what I would code a success.
that is direct, and that may not be asking for the ranch, and that may be okay. Charles, you're from Cleveland, Tennessee. You understand how Jesse feels because of, unfortunately, with the times that obviously in terms of the home state where you are from, the UT side of things in football, so he's looking forward to that. I think that they're actually going to make a turn, but back to with him is like he was always looking for United to give some consistency. Is Barcelona, do they get their folks back, in terms of Neymar, or if not, do they sell Coutinho and make sure what will the profit be there, or are you guys just going to try to run it back with the squad?
I think we're gonna give Dembele another year.
Okay. So Dembele, who goes to the bench then?
It depends on if we get Neymar back. We're gonna sell Coutinho, so there'll be room for Dembele and Coutinho, not Coutinho, Dembele and Griezmann to play at the same time. So hopefully we can get that to work. I'm hoping we keep Malcolm. Yeah. Okay. My feelings on Malcolm. I still can't figure out why we're trying to sell him.
Agreed.
I feel like he needs to be getting more burn. But I mean, unless Madrid makes some things happen more than getting Hazard, I think they're going to need more than that if they want to close the gap on us. So
I agree.
We'll be fine. I mean, other than the hiccup we had in the Copa del Rey and in the Champions League, I mean, it wasn't a bad season. Collectively, just there were three or four bad moments in the season that really defined it towards the end. But that was I feel like we peaked a little too early. To be honest, we'd be struggling down the stretch, but we're still in a good position. I think we got two or three more years of Messi still doing Messi things. So as long as he's still putting on the 10 jersey, man, I still got faith.
Transfer season is the best season. It's going to be great leading up to the domestic campaign starting in August.
Not to mention we're getting the best young midfielder in the world, young Frankie. So that's gonna help immensely with the problems we were having in the middle of the park controlling the ball and making those three passes, being aggressive. My young lion, Frankie, coming from Ajax. I'm super hyped. Might get me a 21 jersey for next season.
Oh, there you go. To let everybody know where you can be able to find the pod here, Charles.
Oh yeah, we're gonna put this up on all the streaming services: Apple, Spotify, all that good stuff. Make sure you check us out on Instagram at Charles Little 15. Also the same thing on Twitter. Just keep sharing, keep rocking with us, staying with it. Good times.
Always great to talk to you. Appreciate everybody coming on. Absolutely. Thanks so much for joining and coming on. That is a wrap for us. Charles, send us off for the weekend.
And enjoy your weekend. Holla.